Okay, so here we are then in week, I think it's week six, and I left us in the 1970s, and so we have in 1974 then the Labour government again in office. Now, I don't know how much you know about politics, but when you look at Britain and you see 1964 Labour, 1970 Conservatives, 1974 Labour, 1979 Conservatives, you think, well, the English, they're always changing their minds. And that's not the correct way to look at it. What actually happens is, first of all, you must remember that when Labour win, or when the Conservative win, they normally win with about 53, 54, maybe 55% of the votes. In Britain, you never win with 70% of the votes. It's impossible. And so really, you've got this change of about 10% in the middle. Now, that's not very much. But you also must particularly remember that the two big parties, the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, are always thinking about how to win the next election. Now, this is perfectly honourable, because if you believe you have good ideas for organising the society, then in a democratic society, obviously you have to win the elections. It would be stupid to say, I'm doing politics. If you're in a parliamentary party, it would be stupid not to be interested in winning. And so, because they win, what they try to do is to adapt, to some extent, what are the most important questions for the population. And this is the reason that in a period when the population has more conservative ideas, then the Labour Party will generally reduce the more radical discourses and move over towards the centre. And on the other side, for example, in the 1950s, when the welfare state, free hospitals were extremely popular, nationalisation was extremely popular, then the Conservative Party, they moved towards the centre and they didn't talk about privatisation anymore. So what you've got is a continual movement from the parties, which is not about honesty or dishonesty, it's about the way that they see the importance of, first of all, winning the election, and then still being able to do what you plan to do. And sometimes governments succeed in doing things that they didn't talk about. I mentioned the example of the legalisation of abortion, and the legalisation of homosexuality by the Labour government in 1967, but in the 1964 and 1966 election, they didn't talk about this, because they thought that although they were convinced it was a good idea, these two laws, they were also convinced that there were a lot of people in the population who were not so sure. And so you get all those sorts of things going on. So when we have a Labour government then in 1974, it means that it means that, you know, 55% or so of the population had more confidence in the Labour Party. So the Labour Party won under the leadership of Harold Wilson, but only 2 years later he resigned. Not quite sure why. Well, we're not quite sure why, but he resigned in any case and passed on to James Callaghan. I'm never sure if this is pronounced Callaghan or Callaghan. I think it's Callaghan, actually. James Callaghan. I think it's Callaghan. I mentioned that he was the oldest candidate. He was 64 years old, and one of the reasons he won was that he was the least divisive candidate. It wasn't that so many people loved him, but nobody hated him. I don't want to sound excessively cynical. He had a difficult time from the point of view of maintaining his majority, because Labour had a very small majority in the House of Commons of four or five. They had four or five more seats than half. And of course, when you have 650 members of Parliament in total, and many of them are old, then sometimes they die. And if you have a majority of only four, this becomes a serious problem. And in fact, in 1977, Labour's majority disappeared. There was no longer a majority for Labour in the House of Commons, which makes every law difficult to pass. Yeah? Every time you want to pass a law, you have to persuade two or three of the small parties to vote with you. And so after 1977, although there was not a formal coalition, the Labour government was dependent on the Liberal members of Parliament. Remember the general situation, 300 Labour members, 300 Conservative members, approximately, and 20 Liberals. But the 20 Liberals became very important because the Labour Party needed them. There was a couple of important moments in the time that Callaghan was in office. First of all, just before this, in 1974, something. So this is under Harold Wilson. An important economic fact happened, which was not because of the Labour Party or because of the Conservative Party. They discovered, or they began to exploit oil in the North Sea. A lot of oil. Now, as you know, in a modern economy, finding oil near your country, this is good news, very, very good news. And North Sea oil certainly brought an enormous amount of money in. And it changed everybody's house. It changed everybody's house because before the 1970s, at home, you had gas, of course, and the gas was made out of coal. They made the gas out of coal in, I don't know where, somewhere. But after the 1970s, they changed the situation and they used what we call natural gas. That is gas which comes from the oil fields. That means that in every house they had to change the cookers because it's not the same size of pipes or something technical. My father worked in gas, he could have explained it. So an important economic fact, then, the discovery of North Sea oil, a lot of money. The amount of North Sea oil is now beginning to go down, but this was certainly something tremendously important. However, in 1976, British economy had a particularly difficult time with the need for borrowing money, and in particular with the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the International Monetary Fund lend a lot of money. They don't lend it to individuals. Don't phone them up and ask them if they'll buy you a computer. They won't. The International Monetary Fund, they lend money to countries. And in 1976, there was a certain amount of conflict between Britain and the International Monetary Fund about loaning money. Yeah, of course, this is the IMF. Of course, in French you call it the FME, because in French you do everything backwards. Okay, approximately. So this was a rather a shock for Callaghan, just like it had been for Wilson, the IMF, because the IMF, when they lend your country money, they always say, or generally say, we will lend you money if you reduce your social budgets. This is the kind of condition going on. And so, indeed, Callaghan began to try to reduce the cost of the welfare state, the cost of the hospitals, the pensions, the unemployment benefit, etc. Now, reducing the cost of the welfare state is very difficult. First of all, because the population is getting older, and because the health service is so good, people live longer, and so this is expensive. It's expensive when people live longer. And so, really, the governments of the 1970s and the 1980s never really reduced the cost of the welfare state. They just stopped it from rising so quickly. It was going like this, and they made it go like this, as a general sort of summary of the situation there. But of course, people don't like it. Yeah, when people suddenly say, oh, well, you had a local hospital, but we're going to close your local hospital, and for the hospital you must go to the big town. Well, obviously people are unhappy, and so there's a certain number of campaigns and against the cuts. And in this moment, you got a symbolic event, because during this period, when quite a number of people were worried about budget cuts, there was 1977, which was the Queen's Silver Jubilee. That is to say, it was 25 years since she was queen. And this was launched as a fairly major national celebration. I was at school, and then, you know, every school child in the country received a special something with saying the Queen's Silver Jubilee, isn't this wonderful, or something. I can't even remember exactly what it was, but something like that. This was celebrated across the country with a certain amount of popular success. It was quite normal to see in Britain street parties, des fêtes de rue, to celebrate the Queen's Silver Jubilee. Now, remember, the British don't really have street parties normally. It's not like Spain, you know. So this was rather surprising. It was genuinely popular around the country. And that brings in a point of contrast, in the sense that 25 years later, for the 50th anniversary of the Queen's Jubilee, of the Queen's coronation, as far as I know, there were almost no popular street parties. So something had changed. Now, what exactly had changed is complicated to see. Yeah, maybe people's attitudes to the Queen, maybe people's attitudes to street parties. 25 years is a long time. But certainly 1977 was noted by that. Whereas the political campaigns, the left-wingers, organised in 1977 a series of demonstrations and badges, I remember, under the slogan, stuff the Jubilee, fight the cuts. So this was a left-wing slogan in 1977. Stuff is a polite word, relatively polite word, to replace another word beginning with F. Stuff the Jubilee, yeah, the Jubilee. On s'en fout du Jubilee, il faut se battre contre les coupes budgétaires. Stuff the Jubilee, fight the cuts. And of course it scans in English, stuff the Jubilee, fight the cuts. The other major cultural event to coincide with 1977, the Queen's Jubilee, was the rapid rise of punk rock. Punk rock suddenly hit Britain in 1977, and of course the most famous song which represented this currents was the Sex Pistols, who sang the song God Save the Queen. How many people have heard the song God Save the Queen by the Sex Pistols? Now, that is very, very interesting, because this is like 1977, how many years ago? Like 40 years ago? So this was, from a pop music point of view, a major success, that in another country where you listen to very different sorts of music, I'm sure you don't all listen to punk music in general, so a major cultural success that it's still well known so much later. And certainly punk brought, so I'm going to mix now, it was not a political campaign against the Queen. It was an angry song at a moment when life was hard, unemployment was rising, the budgets, the social budgets were being cut, and everybody was having, there was a very popular celebration of the Queen, and so this was a response, a very, very sarcastic response, the text, yeah, of course, God save the Queen, we mean it, man, we love our Queen. Now, from the point of view of popular music, this was extremely new, extremely new. Not disrespecting the Queen, that's not important, but sarcastic rock songs. Yeah, punk rock, in my opinion, invented the sarcastic rock song. Yeah. So, remember the classic rock and roll song, we're having a party on Saturday night and we're going to dance all night. It's wonderful. It's never sarcastic. Even the songs which the hippies were singing at the beginning of the 70s, they're not generally sarcastic. They may be ironic, social commentary, etc. But punk introduced a sarcastic song, God Save the Queen, and there are many more. And there's one of the Sex Pistols songs called I'm a Lazy Sod. Yeah, je suis un enfoiré paresseux. So, again, this kind of song is impossible in the 50s and 60s. Now, why did punk rock suddenly arrive in the 1970s? That's quite difficult, but certainly the arrival of the crisis and mass unemployment is linked. Now, when you have a crisis and mass unemployment, this does not automatically produce new musical movements. But I think that if somebody had invented sarcastic, cynical, rebellious rock music in 1955, it would have been impossible. You'd be singing, you know, No Future. And people say, well, what are you talking about, No Future? We all have a job. Our houses are better than our parents. Well, everything's getting better. Why are you talking about No Future? So it was possible in the 1970s because, I think also because of the beginning of the crisis. You see, fortunately or unfortunately, probably unfortunately, today we look at mass unemployment, 3 million, and we think it's terrible. But yeah, but when mass unemployment was new, yeah, that suddenly the terrible thing which we thought had disappeared forever came back. That was a much bigger shock, I think. Yeah. Today, if you are very shocked by mass unemployment, life is very hard because it's all over the place. Okay, so that's just something about the cultural atmosphere and this big political event. Then the jubilee of the Queen's coronation. Callaghan will have problems with the. Callaghan will have problems with the trade unions because, again, Callaghan will continue to try to limit, in the name of solving the crisis or helping the crisis, will try to limit wage rises, and people will be certainly feeling that their living standards are getting worse. Now, it's very difficult to, it's quite difficult to actually measure living standards, yeah? Because if you take your living standards today and you compare them to your parents' living standards when they were your age, they're quite difficult to compare. You could, if you count just the money, you probably have more money. On the other hand, if you count comforts, it can be hard to count. And certainly, you have needs which your parents didn't have. Yeah. Today, some people, you know, I mean, I'm sure some students just really don't have enough money to have a mobile phone and internet. And today, if you don't have a mobile phone and internet, oh well, how can I find a job to work on Saturdays to have a mobile phone and an internet? And of course, in the 1950s or 60s, well, this wasn't a problem because there was no internet. So we have far more needs today, and so it can be difficult to compare living standards. But certainly, in the 1970s, people were feeling that living standards were either going down or they had stopped going up. People were used to every few years things get a little bit better, and then suddenly they weren't doing so. Okay, now I'm going to go on to Margaret Thatcher in just a moment, but I wanted to see if I wanted to have one more thing. Yes, there is a 1976 event I wanted to talk about, which is part of the history of gay rights in Britain. Now, the history of gay rights in Britain was then of rising repression in the 1950s. The 1950s was the worst time to be gay in Britain. You could be arrested and imprisoned. Whereas in the 30s, in theory, you could be arrested and imprisoned, but in fact, the police were not interested. In the 1950s, that was the worst time. And suicide rates and so on were very significant. 1967, then legalization of male homosexuality in private, but not on the same terms as straight couples. So it was, you had to be 21 if you were gay, whereas 18 was enough if you were straight. But there was one other particular event which is a little bit symbolic in the 1970s, and that is that in 1976 the newspaper Gay News, which was the main gay newspaper, was prosecuted by a famous conservative moralist, Mary Whitehouse. And so it was prosecuted, la porte plainte, and the reason that she attacked, well, the real reason that she attacked it is that she was against homosexual groups and homosexual newspapers. But the law that she used was the law against blasphemy. That is, in Britain, and I'm pretty sure it's still the case today, it is in theory illegal to blaspheme, that is, to insult God. And of course, in France, this is not illegal. In fact, in France, it's a national sport. Which personally, I don't think is a very good thing. But I think it's good that it's not illegal. Now, in reality, as you imagine, the blasphemy law is almost never used. But it does still exist. And so Gay News had published a poem about Jesus, saying that Jesus was homosexual, and giving some details. Okay, the title of the poem is "The Love That Dares to Speak Its Name." The Love That Dares to Speak Its Name was the title of the poem. Now, you can find the poem on the internet, but let me say that it's not the kind of poem that my mother would want me to read to young adults in class. Yes, I won't be doing so. But it became a political, a big political conflict, so they were in court for blasphemy, and so this led to a debate where people defended or did not defend either Gay News or the poem itself. As you can imagine, the real objective was not a poem. The real objective was the newspaper itself. And the newspaper lost. Yeah, so the tribunal decided that they were guilty. So this was quite a significant element that although being gay was now legal, gay newspapers were under attack by moralist organisations with a certain amount of success. For example, W.H. Smith, the biggest distributor of newspapers in Britain, said, because of this, we refuse to sell Gay News. And so it became very difficult to find the newspaper around the country. So this is really, it's a symbol, but it's a sign that although ideas about homosexuality were changing, it was very slow. And certainly in the 1970s, but even in the early 1980s, when I was your age, there were not many people defending gays. Yeah, if you were in a group and you heard something very negative about gays, probably nobody would say anything. That was the situation at the time. This can still happen, but the situation is certainly better now. My daughter, who's 15, came home from school last year, and she said, "In my class, all of the girls are in favour of gay marriage, and half the boys." I said, "Well, how do you know?" And she said, "Oh, well, I wrote on my arm, 'Mariage pour tous, pour provoquer le débat.'" That's my daughter. What can you do? That's okay. I blame the parents. I blame the parents. Okay. So the crunch came in 1978-1979, which has often been referred to by journalists, of course, as the winter of discontent. The winter of discontent. Now, this expression comes from a quotation from Shakespeare, but it actually comes from a mistaken quotation from Shakespeare. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that the hiver du mécontentement, that is to say, a winter when there were a lot of strikes. The difficulty with strikes from the point if a party is trying to win an election, the difficulty with strikes is that at the beginning of a strike, the people who are unhappy think, "Oh, it's the fault of the strikers," or, "Oh, it's the fault of the bosses." But after 3 weeks, everybody thinks it's the fault of the government. That seems to be a sort of general rule. And so, certainly, Callaghan lost the election, largely because people had the impression that he didn't have a solution to the strikes. These were mostly public sector strikes, and the Conservative newspapers had a big campaign against the strikes with very, very spectacular headlines. I remember seeing a headline, They won't even let us bury our dead, because some of the strikers were at the local cemetery. Yeah, and so there was a big hoo-ha about that. And so we arrive in May 1979, and the Conservative Party wins the elections, and of course under their new leader, Margaret Thatcher. So Margaret Thatcher, the first woman leader of a political party in Britain, of a major political party in Britain, and the first woman Prime Minister in Britain. Now, of course, that made it an important event, it made it a very striking event, but of course, at the time, we didn't know how long the Conservatives would stay in power. We thought, well, 4 years, maybe. And in fact, the Conservative Party came into office in 1979 and remained in office for 18 years. 18 years of Conservative government, yeah. So obviously that counts for the Conservative Party as a major success to stay in office for 18 years. Yeah, I don't know if in France this has been possible. It sounds very, very difficult to do. Now, this was not Margaret Thatcher for all the time. Margaret Thatcher was was Prime Minister for 11 years. But nevertheless, 11 years is, you know, is considered to be a pretty successful run. And so now, and also next week, of course, I'm going to look then at what Thatcher and Thatcherism represent. So let me start with a general definition. Thatcherism, the conservatism of the crisis, which is a little bit my personal opinion on why she was so successful. I said 11 years and your party for 18 years, that's a big success, so why? And secondly, I'm going to look today at Thatcher and the welfare state. And thirdly, at Thatcher and the trade unions. That's not the end of what I have to say about Margaret Thatcher, but that's the maximum I can do today. And then I'll continue with Margaret Thatcher next week, because she's obviously very important. So let's first of all start with the actual word itself. Thatcherism. Now, of course, as you know, ism is a suffix which refers to an ideology or a theory. Yeah, Marxism, communism, socialism, structuralism, post-structuralism, modernism. Yeah, it is an ideology or a theory. So I wonder how many more British politicians have isms? Because not everybody has an ism. You don't automatically get an ism. Yeah. Any more? Can you think of any French ones who have an ism? Yeah? Yeah, absolutely. General de Gaulle represented something, and he is Gaullism, yeah? Any more in France? Presidents. Mitterrandisme. Have you heard the word Mitterrandisme? It used to be quite common. Yeah. There are three or four that you get. And in Britain, you can hear Thatcherism, Benism, Blairism. These are the three which come to mind. So obviously, when you become an ism, this obviously counts as a success politically, because it means your ideas were so important that they needed a new name. Notice, for example, it's not so much about achievement in itself, because there is not Churchillism. And nevertheless, you know, most people think that Churchill was pretty successful. Yeah? It's hard to say exactly what makes an ism, but I suspect that it has to be not only successful but new. It has to be something new, so you need a new word for it. Thatcherism to represent the conservatism of the crisis, Blairism, which represents the new approach which rose in the Labour Party in the 1980s, 1990s. And Ben, who you saw briefly on the video about Harold Wilson, this is Tony Benn, who was the most left-wing leader, the most left-wing of the leading members of the Labour Party. So Bennism represented the most radical form of parliamentary politics in Britain. On serait autour de Jean-Luc Mélenchon comme les idées, à peu près. Yeah. That's that kind of idea, yeah. So working in parliaments, but a very left-wing one. So obviously successful. And notice, of course, that you do not hear in France cressonisme, pour la première femme premier ministre de la France. In fact, I think many people have forgotten that there was already a French woman prime minister, which in itself is quite an achievement, to be the first woman prime minister and then have people forget you. That is really, you know, that's really got a it's got a certain style involved in it. Okay, so Thatcherism. Now, Thatcherism, in a very general sense, is a much more confrontational and much more determined form of conservatism. So, where, of course, conservative governments and the Conservative Party have always considered trade unions to be the opposition, to be a problem, Thatcherism is much more determined to reduce the power of trade unions as the first priority. In the same way, although conservative parties and conservative governments have always considered that spending money on the welfare state is kind of problematic, Margaret Thatcher was determined to reduce the cost of the welfare state. In the same way, whereas conservatives always considered nationalisation to be perhaps necessary sometimes, but really a pity, Margaret Thatcher was opposed to all nationalisations, and so those are the most important elements of Thatcherism. The fact that these ideas are relatively uncompromising and determined is not to be read simply in the personality of Margaret Thatcher. Of course, Margaret Thatcher had a reputation as la dame de fer, the Iron Lady, but in reality, when you bring in a new policy which transforms the situation, your personality is not enough. Your personality does not have that kind of power. In fact, what happened is that Thatcher represented a whole section of the Conservative Party and of the elite who were determined to change the situation, reduce the power of the trade union, and so on. So she represents a current of thought. Her own personality is not the most important element. You also have to remember that her own personality and image is very much fabricated. I'm sure that you remember some pictures of her always dressed rather old-fashioned clothes, rather old-fashioned hair. This was completely invented. Yeah? In 1970, she didn't dress old-fashioned, and she didn't have dressed old-fashioned hair. In 1978, she did. She decided that this was the image which was going to be successful. This very, very professional approach of communication, public relations, and so on. So I would warn against exaggerating the effect of her personality or even her personal element. For example, people say, "Oh, Thatcher never accepted a compromise." This is completely ridiculous. If you are prime minister of a major country, you accept 25 compromises every day. There are so many questions to do. Now, on certain questions, of course, she refused to compromise where others would have compromised. But the idea that she could refuse all compromise is completely ridiculous. You cannot run a country like that. You cannot run a democratic country like that. In fact, even if you are a dictator, you have to make a lot of compromises. You know, or you become a dead dictator. Yeah. I just want to brush aside some of the very simplistic ideas that you can see in newspaper articles about Margaret Thatcher. So, The conservatism of the crisis, this is my idea, that Thatcherism is the conservatism of the crisis. That is to say that in the 1950s and the 1960s, it was easy for companies to make money because the economy was in very good shape. And so if companies in the 1950s and 1960s had to pay more taxes for hospitals, more taxes for new universities, they thought, well, we don't like paying taxes, but, you know, the economy is in good shape, it's okay. However, when the crisis arrived, it became difficult for companies to make profit. And at this point, then they were no longer prepared to say, okay, 10% wage rise, that's okay, we're making a lot of money. Okay, more taxes for hospitals and so on, that's okay. And so, in general, employers and other sections of the elite became much more rigid and wanted to reduce taxes. And certainly one of the elements of Thatcher's governments is that the percentage of tax paid by rich people went down an enormous drop in taxes paid by rich people. That is to say, the income tax in particular, but also corporate tax, etc., etc. Now, this is Thatcher had to deal with more or less the same groups of problems as Wilson and Heath. That is, you know, one, the welfare state, keeping people happy and making things better. Trade unions, what is the correct intervention for governments? Northern Ireland, what on earth can you do with a half independent ex-colony? Europe, what is the best way to cooperate in an increasingly internationalized economy? So these four big questions, they come back for every government. So it's not surprising to see they came back for Thatcher. So looking at Thatcher and the welfare states, the welfare states, we always think of it immediately as, you know, hospitals, doctors, schools, universities. But it's much more than that, much more than that. It's a general conception of the state's job is to take care in some detail of its citizens. For example, if you have children who go to school and they eat in the school canteen, there are at least two ways in which the welfare state intervenes. First of all schools have a canteen. No? Because that's considered to be part of what is necessary. Secondly, in the canteens, in the classic era of the welfare state, you cannot eat anything. You have nutritionists, you have a certain political decision on what is a balanced meal, etc. So this is the welfare state. You know, it's not every child eats what they want. You know, they can, if they want to buy chocolate and crisps, that's okay. No, it's the welfare state. It's the idea that it's a political job to look after what children eat. And thirdly, you have free school meals. The poorer children do not pay. They simply have it free. So that's just an example in schools. But in general, the welfare state is an enormous series of laws, for example, on nutrition, on housing. The welfare states in many countries like France and Britain say, if you want to rent a very, very small place with only 4 square meters, if you want to rent it to somebody to live in, this is illegal. You can't do it, because it's considered to be not acceptable, and it's a government law, the government's job to deal with it. So the welfare state is simply the idea of politics involving many, many parts of your everyday life. And you occasionally again get very simplified statements about Thatcher and the welfare state, and it's easy to find if you look in newspapers or on the web, it's easy to say, oh, Thatcher abolished the welfare state. This is completely untrue and probably impossible. But what Thatcher certainly did was to reduce as much as she could the scope of the welfare state. Why did she do this? For two basic reasons. Number one, she wanted to reduce... when I say she, of course I mean her and all her friends and followers and supporters and her group. Yeah, but we, for a short time, she wanted to reduce taxes, in particular taxes for businesses, because she believed that the way for society to run better is to have the maximum freedom for business. So it's an ideology. It's not because she didn't like hospitals. It's that she thought that it was good, that private business was better. And so taxes must be reduced. There's the second thing, that Thatcherism considers that the best way to organise human activity is the business. That people work better in a business than they do in a publicly owned thing. This is the idea of Thatcherism. So let's take hospitals, for example. Hospitals are generally public organisations, in Britain. Free. They're still free, but free when you arrived. The people in them were paid by the governments. Now, in some countries, for example, in a large part of America, many, many private hospitals, where the problem is, who will pay? And so it's insurance. If you have a job, you have insurance, and then you go to the hospital, and they say that costs a lot of money, and your insurance pays it, etc. A private system. Now, in Britain, it was impossible for Margaret Thatcher to say, we're privatising the national health system. But political suicide, absolutely impossible. However, what she could do, or what she did do, was to privatise little bits of it, bit by bit. So, for example, she would oblige hospitals to have private canteens, and then oblige hospitals to have private x-ray departments, where you go to get your x-rays, your radiography. Yeah. So services were privatized. Now, again, this was a long process. This was a long process because the government could not say, we oblige you all to privatize your canteens and your x-ray departments. Because that's not how government works. What they had to do was to encourage this process. They couldn't make it obligatory, it was politically impossible. So they had to encourage it. And so, for example, they said, you must use competitive tendering. And this is what we call compulsory competitive tendering. Obligation d'appel d'offre commerciale. That is to say that under one of the new laws under Thatcher, if you were, for example, a council and a local council, and you had your local council workers who went to collect the rubbish, you were obliged every 5 years to say, okay, does any private company want to do this job of collecting the rubbish? And you were obliged to, the local council was obliged to compare private company, public company, the old system, and see which one is cheaper and take the cheapest. So that's a good example, actually. The local council who organized the collecting of rubbish, a very, very important part of our lives, they were obliged every 5 years to check if a private company could do it cheaper. And so, for example, in one town, maybe a private company was then going to do the rubbish collection. Les éboueurs. And now, this is a particular form of privatisation. It's not complete privatisation, because in this town where the private company is now collecting the rubbish, the individual houses, they do not pay the people who are collecting the rubbish. So it is public money. The money comes from the taxes, but a private company does the job. And this was the first, the most important model of Thatcherism in relation to the welfare state. Let's see which parts of public service can be done with public money by private companies. So you notice it's a kind of partial privatization. It's not a complete privatisation. A complete privatisation is, okay, we close the rubbish collection. There's no more rubbish collection. And if you want your rubbish collection collected, you must pay a company. And in that case, you would probably have five companies in the town, each going to different groups of people. And you can imagine that it probably wouldn't work very well. It probably wouldn't work very well. So you have this kind of partial privatisation where private companies do work for the public sector with public money. And this will slowly be introduced around the place. Now, the Conservatives under Thatcher justified and said, well, look, it's cheaper. Your taxes will be lower. It's a good idea. But also, they generally said, private companies are better. Private companies are better because, in the ideas of Thatcherism, competition is the natural and good way for human social activity to be organised. So it's a different philosophy to the general philosophy of the welfare state. It's that individuals and companies in competition do a better job. And of course they would say, whereas the old method, it's bureaucracy, it doesn't work so well. On the other hand, the more left-wing people who criticised Margaret Thatcher, who defended the previous welfare state method, they say, no, we don't agree, because if you look at your private company who is collecting the rubbish cheaper, look at the wages, look at the working conditions, they are not so good. The workers are having a worse time. So we believe, this is the old welfare state idea, we believe it's better to have publicly organised services with decent working conditions. That's why we defend the old way. So you have here a conflict between two philosophies, a sort of collectivist philosophy, which says that, you know, it's good to have a social way of organising, and the Thatcherist philosophy, which is to say that it is not possible for private companies to organise everything in society, but the more they organise, the better. Now these ideas existed within the Conservative Party, have always existed in the Conservative Party. But in the 1950s, the 1960s, and the beginning of the 1970s, they were a minority current. And with Margaret Thatcher and the crisis, they become a majority. Margaret Thatcher often referred to a philosopher called Hayek, who is one of the, I wonder if I've got his name here somewhere, who is one of the philosophers of what is sometimes referred to as methodological individualism. That is to say, that the most important changes in society come through individuals. And so, for example, for the methodological individualists, if you want to understand unemployment, you have to look at the individuals and say, why did he decide to be unemployed? Yeah, that's the philosophical idea. These are very old ideas from the 19th century, but they came back in, and they are symbolised in what Margaret Thatcher famously said. She was asked about the effect of society on crime, and she replied, "There is no such thing as society. La société ça n'existe pas." Okay. This is obviously it's a soundbite, but a very symbolic one. Now, to give you the complete quote in two parts. There is no such thing as society, there are only individuals. And so the argument was, well, you can see that there is more poverty in this part of town, and this leads to an increase in crime. So she said, no, there is no such thing as society, there are only individuals who decide to become criminals. So that's the political view. But the interesting thing is that the complete quote is even longer, and she actually said, there is no such thing as society, there are only individuals and families. Which is very, very interesting. And there's a pause there after individuals. Because although in one sense the philosophy of Thatcherism is there are only individuals choice is what's important. and individual choice causes all the problems, and individual choice will find all the solutions. In reality, of course, to stay within conservative ideologies in general, she was obliged to yes, and families, yes. Because, of course, the family and defence of the family is tremendously important in conservative ideology. Okay, so what did she do? Certainly, she also used her image in a very intelligent way. She was an expert at using her image, and one of the classic uses of her image means that she has sometimes been accused of populism. Now, populism is a word, you always should be a little careful using the word populist, because you don't want to use it too generally. But in general, populism is the idea of being ordinary. Vote for me, I'm an ordinary person, I'm just like you, vote for me. And this was very strong for Margaret Thatcher. For example, she very often said, we must reduce our expenditure in the country. Every housewife knows that if at the end of the week you're spending more money than is coming into your family, then you need to think again. So the idea is, one, running a country is the same as running a family, and two, I am an ordinary person like ordinary housewives. And in particular, she very often suggested, I will send in the army. She very often suggested that she didn't need experts. She said, oh, well, experts. Well, what we need is common sense. Ordinary people understand what is necessary. Experts are not useful. This is a populist idea. In reality, this is completely ridiculous. If I make you prime minister tomorrow, you need a lot of experts. You just, because nobody can be an expert in industry and foreign policy, and you know, so every prime minister always uses a lot of experts. Otherwise, you wouldn't last a week, you wouldn't last a day. And in reality, Margaret Thatcher, like all other prime ministers, when she went on holiday with some experts to have classes in the morning, classes in economics, classes in foreign. Of course, that's what any serious prime minister would do. But for the image, she liked to present this idea, I'm just an ordinary person, ordinary people understand what is necessary, these experts are confusing us. So what did all this lead to, these ideas? Well, it certainly led in the welfare state, not just to this compulsory competitive tendering, which I mentioned, but also to a large number of privatizations. So those companies which were privatized in 1945, gas, telecommunications, British Rail, they were little by little privatized. Now, British Rail took a long time to privatize, but British Gas was privatized, yeah, so it was a nationalized company, and it became a private company. This is not something she could just decide to do. She also had to persuade the population that it was a good idea, or persuade some of them it was a good idea. And one of the things she tried to do was to encourage what has sometimes been referred to as shareholder capitalism. So you had British Telecom, big company. And if she had sold British Telecom to McDonald's, for example, that was possible, make a lot of money. But it's politically difficult. All the opposition would say, British Telecom was our national company. It belonged to everybody. And now it belongs to McDonald's or IBM or something. So that was politically difficult. So what she did was, at the beginning, was, I'm going to sell British Telecom, but nobody can have more than 10 shares. So no big companies, just individuals. And so many, many people across the country bought a small share of British Telecom. Now, this was presented, the idea was, So the defence from Thatcher's point of view was, before, British Telecom was a bureaucracy which belonged to the government. And now it is a democratic capitalism because everybody owns a little bit. That's the Thatcherite idea. And the people who criticised her said, this is completely ridiculous. In 5 years' time, all of these people will have sold their shares to a big company because they want the money. And in reality, you are privatizing, but trying to disguise it as something else. So that was a big ideological and political debate. And of course, naturally enough, to encourage the population to think it was a good idea, when British Telecom was sold, it was sold very cheap. So in reality, if you found 500 euros to buy a few shares in British Telecom, 2 months later you could sell it for 1,000 euros. Now, that's 500 euros profit. It's not a lot of money. But, you know, it might, oh, I'm Margaret Thatcher, you're very good. Yeah. So it was also, there was also that side of it, which is always something which, of course, governments are tempted to do. If a government wants to make a change, then, of course, if they can give a quick advantage to many people, that will help to support the change, even if, in the longer term, that might not be the essential meaning of the change. That's enough for today. Isn't it wonderful having classes which only last 1 hour? We should do this every week. And I'll see you next week for the test. Next week is the test.